Hello, this is Sandra Ferguson with the Friday, September 14th, 2018 edition of the News Gazette. And we'll begin on the front page with a piece about the murder of Holly Cassano called Judge, Ample Evidence for Trial to Proceed. Lab Results, Confession to Sheriff's Investigators Presented at Hearing by Mary Shank, Urbana. For the first time ever, Tony Cassano was in the same room as the man accused of brutally murdering her daughter. The mother of the late Holly Cassano didn't initially realize he was actually in the crowded courtroom Thursday afternoon, expecting to see him on a video screen instead. "I saw the back of his head. I'm over a lot of this now," she said of her reaction to seeing the diminutive Michael Henslick from two rows behind him. "It's just a process now." Thursday's preliminary hearing for the 30-year-old Henslick was the second step in the legal process that follows Henslick being criminally charged on August 28th with the first-degree murder of Holly Cassano, 22, on November 1st or 2nd, 2009, in her home in the Candlewood Estates Mobile Home Park in Mahomet. Champaign County Judge John Kennedy found there was ample evidence for Henslick's case to proceed to trial before Judge Heidi Ladd. The next court hearing in the case is set for October 23rd, but volumes of police reports still have to be relayed to Henslick's attorney, Assistant Public Defender Lindsay Yankus, so it's unlikely the case will be resolved quickly. However, given the overwhelming amount of evidence the state has against the suspect, including his own admission that he killed his former high school classmate, there is a distinct possibility that Henslick might consider a guilty plea. Henslick's admission to sheriff's investigators was part of the evidence presented to Kennedy during a hearing that lasted 11 minutes and 40 seconds. Champaign County Sheriff Sergeant Dave Sherrick, under questioning by state's attorney Julia Reitz, laid out some of the details of the 9-year investigation into Cassano's murder. He said it was Tony Cassano who found her daughter dead on the floor of her bedroom beside her mobile home on DuPage Street on November 2, 2009. Sherrick said an autopsy revealed she had been stabbed 55 to 60 times. There was blood in the bedroom, hallway, bathroom, living room, kitchen, kitchen sink, and even the outside of the door to the home, he said. At the time, Henslick lived with his parents a few blocks away in the same mobile home park. Shortly after the killing, vaginal and rectal swabs, as well as swabs of blood stains on the victim's legs, were sent to the Illinois State Police Crime Lab, where scientists developed a DNA profile from an unknown man. Sherrick said the scientists concluded the semen and the blood came from the same person, leading them to believe the killer was injured during the attack. Over the years, about 100 samples from potential suspects were sent to the lab, but none matched the unknown DNA profile, Sherrick said. Work done this summer by a private genetic genealogy company hired by the sheriff's office revealed that the DNA found inside Cassano's home possibly came from Henslick, who still lived in the same mobile home park with a girlfriend. Despite having been ordered by the courts to provide a DNA sample because of a conviction in a 2015 drug case, Henslick never did so. In response, the state took steps to revoke his probation. In late August, after sheriff's detectives learned Henslick was a possible match, Sherrick said they followed Henslick and picked up discarded cigarette butts to use for comparison samples. "It was a full match," Sherrick said of the comparison between the DNA on the cigarettes and the evidence from the murder scene. Sherrick said detectives learned that Henslick was friends with Cassano's cousin and that he and Cassano were about the same age and in the same class at Mahomet Seymour High School. Sherrick was one of three detectives who interviewed Henslick on August 28th after his arrest. Henslick waived his Miranda rights and agreed to talk to them without an attorney. Asked by Reitz if Henslick admitted his role in the crime, Sherrick replied he did. He said he stabbed her. He said all over. Sherrick said Henslick also said that scars he still has on the inside of both forearms came from the attack on Cassano. Sherrick said detectives took DNA samples from Henslick after his arrest and learned on Wednesday from the state crime lab that they indeed matched the blood and semen samples collected at the mobile home in 2009. For Toni Cassano, nothing she heard in court Thursday was new. However, there were gasps from some of the approximately 50 family and friends who crowded into the pews when Sherrick revealed she had been stabbed 55 to 60 times. While investigators had parsed out certain evidence through the media over the years in an attempt to find her killer, many of the details were kept under wraps. Toni Cassano came to court wearing a new T-shirt that she said she had ordered last year but only picked up on Wednesday. On the front were the words, "Hope for Holly, I miss my daughter." The words "hope" was scratched out and "justice" penciled in above it. Likewise, on the back of the shirt, the words 5 and 8 years later were crossed out and a 9 written in above them. And next we have a piece about Champaign Development called Yards Group in D.C. for Grant Plea by Ben Zigerman, Washington, D.C. After pitching the Champaign City Council on the plan for the Yards development in the southern part of downtown, local officials traveled to the nation's capital to secure federal funding for the estimated $200 million project. The group, including Champaign-Urbana Mass Transit District Managing Director Carl Natt and the University of Illinois Athletic Director Josh Whitman, has been meeting with transit officials, policy advisors, and U.S. Representative Rodney Davis, Republican from Taylorville. The group left Champaign Wednesday morning and returns Friday morning. The meetings have been positive and productive, said Lisa Mead, spokeswoman for the MTD. MTD is particularly grateful for Congressman Davis's strong support of the Yards project. The Yards could include an expansion of the Illinois Terminal, parking decks, 100-plus apartments, another downtown hotel, convention space, and an arena for a potential Division I hockey team. It would use land south of the existing terminal and the Inman Hotel, between Neal and Walnut Streets, and the railroad tracks. The project was presented to the City Council Tuesday, and in response to questions about funding, Nat said it will depend on whether it receives two federal grants totaling $25 million for which MTD has applied. So off to Washington the group went. They're there to help the MTD and support them in their attempt to obtain federal grants, said Kent Brown, spokesman for the UI's Division of Intercollegiate Athletics. Along with Whitman and Nat, the group includes MTD Grants Manager Jane Sullivan, Champaign County Economic Development Corporation Executive Director Carly McCrory, Champaign Planning and Development Director Bruce Knight, and the project's developer Hans Grotelution. They've been meeting with officials from the U.S. Department of Transportation and the Federal Transit Administration, as well as policy advisors to U.S. Senators Dick Durbin and Tammy Duckworth, Davis, and the transportation aide to Representative John Shimkus, Republican from Collinsville. The City Council will continue discussing the project over the next few months, with a presentation on finances coming this October or November, and another in December to present draft agreements. And our next piece is about a landmark hotel. Property sells at auction for $1.3 million by Ben Zigerman, Urbana. After a $3.95 million bid for the landmark hotel failed to meet owner Zhaojin Yuan's reserve price in December, the hotel went up for auction again this week. The owner has lowered his expectations significantly, his broker Rick George said Monday. Indeed, when bidding hit $1.1 million, the online auction said Yuan's reserve had been met, and when it closed at $1.3 million, the website said the historical hotel had been sold. They're fine, Yuan said about the auction's results. Yuan said he doesn't know who the buyer is, but George does. George, a broker with Avison Young in Chicago, could not be reached for comment Thursday. The sale is expected to close within 30 to 45 days. The auction began Tuesday on 10x.com with a minimum bid of $600,000. By Thursday morning, bidding reached $900,000, and it heated up after noon in the final hour of bidding. After it ended, the website said, "Sold." Urbana Mayor Diane Marlin said she is waiting to hear more about the buyer. "I wasn't surprised at the price," she said. Before the auction began, George said he expected 6 to 8 qualified bidders to participate in the auction, and city officials said they had met with about a dozen interested parties from around the country. The hotel has been closed since April 2016 and has been for sale since 2015, when Yuan had an asking price of $5.4 million. He bought it in 2010 for $600,000 and renovated most of the rooms, but returned $1 million in incentives to the city after not reopening the hotel's restaurant and conference center. The historic hotel opened in 1923 as the Urbana-Lincoln Hotel. It was later bought by Carson Peary Scott & Company in 1965 before being sold to the Jumer Hotel chain in the 70s. It was sold again in 2001 and has cycled through various owners since then. Last year, a New Jersey-based firm put together a $24.5 million plan to redevelop the hotel with $9.5 million from the city, but Urbana rejected the plan due to its cost to the city and the risk it would have to play it would have placed on taxpayers. And next, a piece about the Champaign County Nursing Home, Facilities Fate Argued Over at Public Hearing, by Deborah Pressey, Champaign. If Champaign County can't sell its financially strapped nursing home soon, the home will have to be closed, a state board was warned. Some former and current county officials and local business leaders came to a public hearing Thursday in downtown Champaign, urging that a planned $11 million sale of the nursing home be allowed to proceed, while a handful of opponents continued to express doubts about selling to the only taker. The hearing was called to collect public comments for the Illinois Health Facilities and Services Review Board, which will have the final say about the nursing home sale next month. The board staff set aside 4 hours to hear comments, both in the afternoon and evening, and the public will get still another chance to offer views for and against the sale at the October 30th board session. Among those urging the sale was Champaign County Treasurer John Farney, who said the county has robbed Peter to pay Paul to keep a non-mandated service afloat. Failure to complete the sale of the Champaign County Nursing Home will result in the closure of the home, he warned. Retired County Treasurer Dan Welch traced the first signs of financial trouble at the nursing home back to 2002, when the county began dipping into a depreciation fund that was depleted a few years later. That was followed by millions of dollars in loans to the nursing home from the county's general fund, most of which haven't been repaid. Had this been a privately owned nursing home, it would have been bankrupt in 2009, Welch said. County Auditor Diane Michaels said it has been a balancing act trying to absorb the nursing home's losses, and she warned about cuts likely to be on the way for multiple county services if the nursing home isn't sold. The nursing home has been losing $75,000 to $100,000 a month, she said, and it barely met payroll this week. Clearly, we need to go forward with the sale, Michaels said. Champaign County Healthcare Consumers Executive Director Claudia Lanhoff urged waiting, and if county officials ultimately still want to sell, she urged them to find another buyer. The buyers formally identified for the nursing home, Evanston-based Altitude Health Services and Extended Care Clinical, aren't going to be the owners and managers of the nursing home, she pointed out. Two new companies were created last month to own and manage the county nursing home, University Rehab Real Estate, LLC, and University Rehabilitation Center of CU, LLC. Altitude Health Services President William Avi Rothner, also identified as the manager of the new companies, certified in an August 15th letter to the state board that there haven't been any disciplinary actions taken against any nursing home owned by University Rehabilitation Center of CU during the 3 years prior to applying to the state board. The new companies don't have a history of operating any nursing homes at all, Lenhoff said. But research done by her organization did find violations and adverse actions at other Rothner nursing homes. While the county nursing home has suffered significant financial hardships, Lenhoff contended the census and Medicaid payments there have risen, and next month Medicare will begin paying higher rates for rehab services, meaning a brighter financial picture could be ahead. Fellow opponents to the sale, Julie Watkins, asked county officials for leadership and to listen to warnings from people contending the buyers can't be trusted. The nursing home is insurance for the whole community, and maybe we won't need it, but I'm sure glad it's there, she said. Mary Schultz said her mother is a resident at the county nursing home, and she urged going ahead with the sale because it's no longer a choice between maintaining a privately owned nursing home and a publicly owned one. It's a choice between a privately owned nursing home and a shuttered one, she said. And we'll turn now to the opinions page and begin with an editorial called Challenging Challenges. Political gamesmanship between the local political parties is driven by their desire to cut voters out of the democratic process. The big fight between Champaign County Republicans and Democrats will be held on November 6, the date of this year's general election. But Democrats and Republicans gave the public a sign of what is to come when they faced off this week in a political skirmish of challenges each party filed against the other. The forum was a meeting of the county's three-member electoral board, which decides petition challenges as a prelude to taking the issue to the courts for resolution. The board is made up of the county clerk, the circuit clerk, and the state's attorney, in this case, Gordy Halton, Katie Blakeman, and first assistant state's attorney, Steve Ziegler, sitting in for his boss, Julia Reitz. The subject of dispute were challenges to one Republican county board candidate, P.J. Troutman, District 6, and two Democratic board candidates, Chris Storr, District 10, and Charles Young, District 6. But that wasn't just what the dispute was about. Democrats cried foul over what they described as the political bias of Halton, a Republican, in favor of GOP candidate Troutman, and insisted that he should recuse himself. Local Democrats, as they usually do, employed apocalyptic rhetoric to characterize Halton's presence as a decision-maker. Halton's blatant disregard for election law, ethics, and his public endorsement of Troutman make it unacceptable for him to serve on the election board. He must recuse himself from this hearing, said Democratic Party Chairwoman Maryam Rahim. Democrats also sent out a message urging their supporters to show up at the meeting so board members would feel the pressure to adhere to the law and not follow illegal and incorrect guidance from Halton. Unfortunately for the Democrats, they had nothing other than moral outrage to provide as justification for Halton to step down, and that's not enough. Alleged partisanship is not sufficient grounds for removal. Indeed, if it was, it's hard to see how a 3-member board made up of elected political officials or their representatives could effectively function. The presence of partisans is baked, by law, into the process, although that does not mean the board's decisions are, or should be, politically motivated. Indeed, Reitz, the sole Democrat on the 3-member board, said Halton is on solid legal ground in remaining on the board despite the protest. So why all the sound and fury that signified nothing? Well, that seems to be the style these days, despite all the complaints about a lack of civility in civic affairs. Ultimately, the board deferred a decision on the 3 challenges. Republicans challenged the petitions submitted by Storr and Young on the nitpicky grounds they were not submitted in a timely manner. Democrats challenged Troutman because he's running as a Republican, even though he voted in the Democratic primary, an arguable but still marginal claim. Petition challenges, in most cases, are an ugly business that represent party effort to win an election in advance by knocking an opponent off the ballot with some technical claim and running unopposed. That approach shortchanges the voters, who are supposed to have the final word on who wins elections. That reality is why the courts have increasingly given more and more latitude to candidates whose petitions contain minor errors that don't amount to a hill of beans. Remember, the rules on which challenges are based were put in place by the permanent political class to make it hard for political newcomers to find their way into the political arena. To put it simply, they don't want nobody sent, to borrow a popular political phrase characterizing the insularity of the debased politics in this state. Both sides would be well advised to drop their challenges and let the voters work it out. If they declined to do so, the electoral board would best serve the public by taking a forgiving attitude toward these challenges. And we'll turn now to the From Our Readers section, and we'll begin with a piece written by Henry Sider Jr. of Urbana. It's called Dems Engaged in Hate Fest. Rule 13, pick the target, freeze it, personalize it, and polarize it. Relentlessly cut off the support network and isolate the target from sympathy. From Saul Alinsky's 13 Rules for Radicals. Over the past 10 months, 13th District voters have been ruthlessly targeted by the Democratic hate machine. Let's get real here and ask, why are radicals, left-wing activists pulling out all stops and daily demonizing Republican candidate Rodney Davis with such deranged and persistent ferocity? And why has the News Gazette blindly published these almost daily pathological rants? This isn't honest democracy. It's radicals engaged in an Alinsky-inspired hate fest. Clearly, disingenuous Democratic socialist hacks hope to beat down Davis by November, thus bringing their cult of perpetual grievances and partisan hate one step closer to impeaching President Donald Trump. Kremlin and Putin propagandists have empowered the Democratic Party and the deep state with Hillary and DNC purchased $12 million. Russian lies, thus further undermining our election process while pushing this nation closer to a civil war. Why are Democrat socialists disingenuous? Consider this fact. Every outraged left-wing extremist gleefully demonizing Davis for not embracing their long-standing socialist policies was not publicly outraged when their messiah, Barack Obama, and the Democratic leadership did not act on the same leftist fleece the American taxpayer agenda when in total control of both the executive and legislative branches between 2009 and 2011. By contrast, Trump needed less than 15 months to enact 70% of conservatives' pro-American agenda. Hence the radical left's increasingly hypocritical and selective outrage. That again was written by Henry Sider Jr. of Urbana. The next piece is written by Don Moran of Savoy, and it's called Should We Go Back to a Quota System? Today's news of our national immigration policy is everywhere, trying to determine who is responsible for getting us where we are today and where most of us don't want to be is a challenge. As we wrestle with what should be done in our efforts to determine the future of our nation's immigration policy, perhaps we should review our past immigration policy. Our country's first immigration policy, 1880 through 1923, averaged 600,000 annually. During our industrialization, a huge demand for factory workers was created. Immigrants from Europe met the demand with an annual immigration of 500,000 plus. In 1924 and 1926, Congress put in place a comprehensive quota system, restricting immigration to 200,000 annually on average, and so it was from 1925 through 1965. In 1965, Congress initiated a new policy that replaced the quota system that favored immigrants from Europe with a new system that emphasized the reunification of family. Immigration from Latin America predominated. Between 1965 and 1990, annual average immigration was 1 million plus. From 1990 to today, the annual average is estimated to be 1.5 million plus, legal and illegal. A quick peek at the past suggests that from 1925 to 1965, quotas worked. Of course, we had a water barrier wall between the U.S. and Europe, aka the Atlantic Ocean. It's hard to sneak into Ellis Island. Could the same quota system possibly work today if we had a barrier along our southern boundary, aka the wall? I'm just thinking. What do you think? And that again was written by Don Moran of Savoy. The next piece is written by Ray Zielinski of Champaign, called Davis Supports Disastrous Policies. Many recent letters to the News Gazette voiced displeasure with Representative Rodney Davis's refusal to meet with his constituents in an open town hall-style meeting. Honestly, given time to hear and respond to the concerns of constituents is an important facet of being a U.S. representative. The problem with this singular focus is that there are many other reasons not to return Davis to Washington. Ironically, the reasons to vote for Betsy Dirksen Lonergan and not for Davis are presented in the controversial New York Times op-ed piece on September 5th, in which the anonymous author writes, "There are bright spots that the near ceaseless negative coverage of the administration fails to capture. Effective deregulation, historic tax reform, a more robust military. Davis supports these initiatives, and their long-term consequences for the country are grim. Fully implemented, the accomplishments the writer touts will respectively permit industries to dump toxic waste, drill for petroleum in threatened environments, accelerate release of greenhouse gases, and stymie the deployment of alternative energy resources, increase the national debt, and accelerate inequality, and divert more resources into the military when revitalized infrastructure is needed critically. It is time to look beyond the scare tactics of equating Democrats with socialists. Fear-mongering is a reflection of the lack of good ideas. If we want this country to move forward and continue in its leadership position in the world, we need more than the failed policies the administration and Davis promote. We need change in November." And that again is written by Ray Zielinski of Champaign. And we'll take a short break now and then return with the second half hour of the Friday, September 14th, 2018 edition of the News Gazette. I'm Sandra Ferguson. Please stay tuned.